Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 103.
Picture it, this really cinematic split screen. On one side, you have these quiet, silk-draped rooms in this massive aristocrat's estate.
Right, very pristine.
Exactly. And two high-ranking family members are just casually, like, mundanely discussing the mechanics of bribing government officials.
As you do.
Right. Just hushed tones, calculated risks, the invisible architecture of immense wealth. And ironically, they're doing all this corruption just to, you know, protect their family's pristine reputation.
Yeah, it's a world where power requires just relentless maintenance. Every single interaction is about control.
But then you look at the other side of that split screen and the controls just completely shatter.
Absolutely shattered.
Yeah, in another wing of this exact same interconnected compound, a woman is violently thrashing on the floor of a locked room.
Right.
Because she just consumed a bowl of poisoned soup. And what follows is, I mean, it is an absolute masterclass in chaos. We're talking a botched cover-up, stolen jewelry, and literally a brawl between desperate families fighting over the corpse.
It really is the ultimate collision, isn't it? You've got this high society pretense of order on one side, and then just raw, ugly, uncontainable human nature on the other.
And waiting at the very end of this entire chaotic spectrum-like, far away from the bribes and the bloodstained floors, is a mysterious Taoist monk.
Yeah.
He's just sitting alone in a ruined temple by a rapid river, meditating. And he seems to hold, like, the answer to the very nature of reality itself. Today, we are taking you into a profoundly layered narrative, drawn straight from Chapter 103 of a monumental literary text. Our mission today is to really unpack a story that serves as, well, a masterclass in irony.
Definitely.
We're going to explore how extreme worldly ambition, paranoia, and petty malice all sort of ultimately engineer their own destruction. And we'll contrast all that toxic claustrophobic scheming with this stark philosophical escape hatch.
Yeah, we are looking at a brilliant but honestly terrifying microcosm of human folly today. It's really a psychological study wrapped in a locked room mystery, which is itself wrapped in a political thriller.
It really is. So let's start right at the top of that hierarchy, in the realm of high stakes bureaucracy and family survival.
Good place to start.
Jia Lian. And he's reporting back to his aunt, Lady Wang, who is, you know, one of the ultimate matriarchs of this estate.
Right. She runs things.
She totally does. So he's just returned from the Ministry of Personnel. And this ministry is essentially the human resources department for the entire imperial government.
Yeah, they dictate everything. Who gets sent where, who gets promoted, who gets completely sidelined.
Exactly. And Jia Lian is delivering good news. He tells his aunt he's successfully, quote, sorted things out. Lady Wang isn't just pining for her husband's company.
No, not at all.
Her rationale is entirely based on paranoia and risk management.
Yeah, she argues that officials who serve outside the capital inevitably get ruined because out in the provinces, you know, hundreds of miles away from the watchful eye of the central government and the imperial auditors.
The cat's away, the mice will play.
Exactly. And officials, servants, and subordinates just run completely wild. She explicitly notes that these local attendants embezzle money, they extort the local populace, they buy gold and silver for their mistresses, and all of this is happening completely behind the master's back.
So she is terrified of the principal agent problem.
Yes.
Her logic is that her husband will be completely blind to this localized corruption happening right under his nose.
Mm.
But when a hammer inevitably falls, when the auditors figure out the books don't balance, it's the master who takes the blame, not the servant.
Right, the servant just runs off.
Exactly. She's convinced that these mixed-up subordinates will literally cost her husband his life, and by extension, completely wipe out the family's generational legacy and titles.
I mean, this conversation reveals just a stunning level of hypocrisy.
Oh, yeah.
Lady Wang and Jia Lian are actively currently engaging in high-level corruption. They are bribing a federal ministry. They're subverting the imperial will. And they're committing this massive corrupt act specifically to protect Jia Zhang from the accidental corruption of his own staff.
It's wild. It's a phenomenal commentary on systemic rot.
Truly.
You have a system of wealth and power that is so inherently unstable, so structurally unsound, that it requires constant, dirty, illicit maintenance just to maintain a facade of honor.
Right. And the crazy thing is, Lady Wang absolutely does not see herself as a criminal.
No, not at all.
In her mind, she's a pragmatist. The system forces her to break the law at the highest possible level just to prevent her subordinates from breaking the law at the lowest level.
It's like imagine owning a massive, glamorous skyscraper, but the foundation is completely crumbling.
Okay.
And fixing the foundation is impossible. The rot is just too deep. So instead of repairing the building, you just pay off the city safety inspector every single month to sign a piece of paper saying the structure is perfectly safe.
That's a perfect analogy.
You're committing fraud, but you justify it as, like, the only way to keep the doors open and protect the people inside.
Yeah, but I hear what you're saying about corruption, but let's look at it from her perspective for just a second.
Okay, play devil's advocate.
What other choice does she actually have? She knows exactly how this political game is played. She knows her husband might be too naive or maybe too focused on his scholarly pursuits to aggressively manage his staff in a faraway province.
Yeah, he's an academic type.
Right. She is identifying a very real existential threat to her family's physical survival. I mean, getting executed for a subordinate's embezzlement is a real historical risk.
That's fair.
So isn't she just trapped in a bad system, using the only levers of power she has left?
That is a fair defense, actually. And I think it highlights the sophistication of the source material. Like, the text doesn't paint Lady Wang as a cartoon villain twirling a mustache.
No, she's highly competent.
Right. She's a hypervigilant manager of a terribly fragile ecosystem.
Yeah.
But if we pull back and look at the broader implications, it raises a terrifying question about this society.
Just.
If your baseline survival depends on this exhausting, relentless level of hyper-manipulation, is anyone actually secure?
Oh, absolutely not. They are living on a knife's edge disguised as a silk pillow.
Ooh, I like that.
The high status they enjoy isn't a safe harbor. It's a target painted on their backs. They have to continuously hemorrhage political and literal capital just to tread water.
Mm.
The anxiety must just be crushing.
Think about the modern equivalents for a second. You know, the open secrets in massive corporate institutions or even in our own personal lives.
Oh, for sure.
How often do people engage in questionable, exhausting practices or look the other way on glaring ethical breaches just to maintain a baseline illusion of stability?
Right. People convince themselves that the ends justify the means.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because the alternative, letting the system actually collapse, it just feels too terrifying to contemplate.
And that frantic desire to control the environment at the macro level, like bribing ministries and manipulating appointments, it serves as a perfect thematic mirror for what we're about to witness at the micro level.
Oh, definitely.
Because you can try to control the universe all you want, but human nature is fundamentally uncontrollable.
Right, and if Lady Wang thinks she can control chaos from the top down, well, that illusion shatters the second her door gets knocked down by a servant from a neighboring household.
Right on cue.
Literally.
Oh.
Right as Jia Lian is wrapping up his report on their successful political bribery, an old servant woman from the Xu family compound bursts in, and she is in an absolute panic.
Yeah, she drops all basic etiquette, ignores the standard greetings.
Just blurts out that a complete disaster has happened, their house is completely out of control, and she begs Lady Wang to send some of her men over to handle it. When the servant finally stammers out that their first madam, Xie Jinghui, has died, Lady Wang actually spits in disgust.
Yeah.
She literally says, "This kind of woman, if she dies, she dies." The old servant has to trudge back to her own mistress, Aunt Zhu, empty-handed.
Which is tough.
Lady Wang tells Jia Lian to go over anyway to see what all the fuss is about.
Right.
And Aunt Xu is naturally furious that her sister won't send back up. But Jia Lian, and when he arrives, Aunt Xu sits him down and explains the absolute nightmare that has just unfolded.
And to understand that nightmare, we really need to look at the psychological claustrophobia of the Zhu household.
Yes, context is key here.
It's crucial. Because the men of the Xu's family are largely absent. In fact, the deceased woman's husband is currently away facing a death sentence for a previous crime.
Right.
So the women are left behind in this pressure cooker of an enclosed compound. They are tracked with each other, navigating this strict, unforgiving hierarchy that is entirely fueled by resentment and sheer survival panic.
So Aunt Xu starts laying out the timeline for Jia Lian. She explains that Xie Jinghui had been acting incredibly erratically for months.
Understandably, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, she was crying, screaming, running around disheveled because her husband was facing execution.
Mm.
But then, very recently, her behavior flipped completely.
Like a light switch.
Exactly. She started dressing up again. She started wearing her intricate makeup. And most bizarrely, she demanded that its jangling come live in her room to keep her company.
Which is a massive flashing red flag for anyone observing this dynamic.
A completely terrifying shift in behavior.
Mm.
Because Xia Jingui absolutely loathed Zhangli.
Yeah, hated her.
And she even tried to intervene.
Right.
She warned Jingui, like, you hate her. Why bring her into your room just to start fights?
Right.
But Jingui insisted. So the sick, terrified concubine is forced to move into the bedroom of her abuser. And to everyone's shock, Jingui is incredibly sweet to her.
Which, in the psychology of a crime scene, sudden, uncharacteristic kindness from a known abuser is one of the most dangerous indicators possible.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It almost always points to premeditated malice. When someone who thrives on conflict and dominance suddenly becomes accommodating and peaceful, it means they've formulated a plan.
Wow.
They no longer need to fight the daily battles because, in their mind, they have already won the war.
It is terrifying.
It is.
So Aunt Xu tells Jilian that Jingui was going out of her way to personally make soup for Zhangli. And one day, while bringing a bowl over, Jingui accidentally burns her own hand and drops the bowl. It shatters everywhere.
Right.
Now, normally, Jingui would fly into a violent rage and blame Zhangli for, like, standing in the wrong place.
Right. Find a way to make it her fault.
Exactly. But instead, she calmly sweeps up the broken porcelain, mops the floor herself, and acts like nothing happened.
Because she is fiercely protecting the narrative she's constructed, she cannot afford an emotional outburst that would give Zhangli an excuse to flee the room. She has to keep her target close.
Which brings us to the night of the murder. Jingui has her personal maid, Baokin, make two bowls of soup so she and the concubine can eat together. A little while later, Aunt Xu hears agonizing screaming.
Just horrifying.
She runs to the room. Zhangli is stumbling out of the door, absolutely terrified. And inside the room, Jingui is thrashing on the floor.
Yeah.
She's bleeding from her nose and eyes. She's clawing at her own chest, kicking her legs wildly, completely unable to speak. And moments later, she's dead.
I mean, the physical symptoms described there, the violent thrashing, the bleeding from the mucous membranes, the inability to vocalize, they all point to a severe, rapid onset poisoning.
Like arsenic.
Exactly, arsenic, or a very similar toxic agent. It is a violent, unimaginably painful way to die.
So the immediate aftermath is pure panic. Jingui's maid, Baokan, instantly points the finger at the concubine, Zhangli. She starts screaming that the concubine poisoned her mistress. Now, keep in mind, Zhangli is physically ill. She can barely get out of bed on a good day. But Aunt Du's reaction to this accusation is completely mind-boggling. She orders her servants to physically tie up the sick, terrified concubine.
Yeah, Aunt Su's rationale here is fascinating because it is entirely divorced from justice or truth.
Completely.
She doesn't actually believe Zhangli is a murderer. She explicitly tells Jilian, Zhangli isn't that kind of person, and she's too sick to poison anyone anyway.
Then why on earth does she order her to be bound with ropes? It makes no sense.
Because she's operating on a chaotic, backwards pragmatism dictated entirely by the fear of scandal. Aunt Xu is terrified that Zhangli, who is already frail and is now being accused of murdering the lady of the house, will become so distressed that she'll commit suicide.
Oh, wow.
Aunt Xu's thought process is basically, I cannot have two dead bodies in this house. The authorities will descend, the scandal will destroy our remaining reputation, and we will be ruined.
So she ties her up for her own good.
Exactly. She binds the victim of a false accusation to protect her from her own despair. It reveals a household operating in a state of moral freefall, focused purely on damage control.
Yeah, and she literally locks the door, trapping the accused concubine and the accusing maid in the room with the corpse, and just sits outside waiting for morning.
But then, into this emotionally charged, highly irrational, and panicked crime scene, steps a character who operates purely on cold, forensic logic.
Yes.
And this shift in tone is entirely necessary to break the hysteria.
Enter Baochai. She is a younger, brilliant female relative of the Xu family. Baochai walks in, takes one look at the locked room, listens to Aunt Xu's frantic story, and immediately deconstructs the entire scene.
She doesn't panic at all.
No. She's like a detective lifting the police tape and analyzing the blood spatter.
Baochai represents procedural reasoning. While everyone else is drowning in their fear of scandal and emotional chaos, she looks strictly at the mechanics of the accusation.
She asks one simple, devastating question. She says, wait, the maid Baochan prepared the soup, so why is Zhangli the one tied up?
It's such a brilliant deduction.
It is.
Bao Chai instantly identifies the logical flaw in the maid's screaming accusation. If the soup was the murder weapon, the person who prepared and handled the soup is the prime suspect.
Exactly. So Bao Chai immediately orders her own people to go in and tie up the maid, Bao Jun. She levels the playing field.
Right.
And then she does the one thing everyone else has been terrified to do. She insists they must officially report this death to the Ministry of Justice, and they must immediately notify Xia Jingui's birth family, the Xia family.
And this is a pivotal moment in the narrative. Bao Chai is introducing the law into a space that has previously only been governed by family secrets, bribes, and internal power dynamics.
Yeah.
But as we're about to see, the introduction of the law does not instantly create an environment of justice.
Nope.
In fact, it just provides a brand new weapon for the chaos of greed.
Because we have to talk about the Xia family. Jingui's mother and her adopted son arrive at the estate. And the text gives us crucial background here. The Xia family used to be extremely wealthy merchants, but they have completely squandered their fortune.
Yeah, they're broke.
They are broke. They're desperate. Jingui, who had been funneling them money from the Xu estate behind her husband's back, was essentially their only source of income.
Which completely frames their reaction to her sudden death.
Yeah, when they get the news that Jingui is dead, they do not behave like a grieving family. They rush over in a rented, broken-down cart, crying and screaming loudly in the streets to draw as much public attention to themselves as possible.
Right, making a scene.
And when they burst through the doors of the compound, they don't even ask to see Jingui's body.
That is the most telling detail of their arrival. A mother who has just suffered the sudden loss of her daughter doesn't ask to go to the bedroom to mourn. Instead, she immediately starts making wild, loud accusations. She points fingers at the Zhu family, screaming that they murdered her daughter because they were tired of dealing with her. She demands a life for a life.
And it escalates into a literal, physical brawl. The adopted son grabs a heavy wooden chair and tries to smash it over the servant.
Just absolute chaos.
They are physically attacking Aunt Zhu. Jilian, who is still observing all of this, has to call in 7 or 8 strong male guards just to physically subdue this family and stop them from destroying the reception hall.
What we are witnessing here is grief being entirely weaponized for financial gain.
Wow, yeah.
The Xia family sees Jingui's death not as a tragedy, but as a lottery ticket. If they can successfully accuse the wealthy Zhu family of murder, they can extort them for massive financial compensation to keep the matter out of the imperial courts.
It's exactly like a staged slip and fall insurance scam, just with the highest possible stakes.
Yes, exactly.
You walk into a grocery store, you slick on a grape, and before you even check if your leg is broken, you are screaming for the manager and threatening a $1 million lawsuit. The Xia family is doing a slip and fall over their own daughter's corpse.
It's dark, but yeah. But look at it from their perspective for a second. This is where the text's understanding of class and desperation really shines.
Okay, tell me.
They have lost all their money. They have lost their daughter, who was their financial lifeline. They are facing absolute, undeniable ruin.
Yeah, they have nothing left.
Right. In a society where power and wealth are the only safety nets, they have suddenly been stripped of both. So their violent reaction is a raw, incredibly ugly survival instinct. Their only recourse is to use the threat of a public murder scandal to claw back some resources from the much wealthier Su family.
So we have Bao Chai trying to invoke the law to find the truth,
yeah,
and the Xia family trying to exploit the law to get a payout.
It implies that the threat of the law, specifically the impending arrival of the Ministry of Justice to perform an autopsy, is just another tool of leverage. For the Su family, the law is a terrifying risk to their reputation. For the Xia family, the law is an extortion tool. The actual truth of how Jingui died is almost irrelevant to everyone in that room except Bao Chai.
But Bao Chai's cold logic has successfully frozen the chaos. By bringing in the guards to subdue the Xia family,
mm-hmm,
and by establishing that the authorities are literally on their way, she forces everyone to stop screaming and actually look at the physical evidence.
Thank goodness.
And this leads us to the investigation phase, which results in one of the most darkly comedic, brilliantly ironic twists I have ever encountered in a story.
Oh, the irony here is so dense it has its own gravitational pull.
It really does. So the room is secured. The Xia mother finally goes in to see the body, mostly because she realizes she has to pretend to mourn before the police arrive.
Right.
Bao Chai orders the servants to search the bedroom. And they find two crucial pieces of evidence. First, tucked under the mattress, they find a crumpled piece of paper they used to hold arsenic.
Which immediately establishes intent and method. The poison was in the room.
Exactly. Second, They open Jingui's ornate jewelry boxes. They are completely empty. Every single silver hairpin, every piece of gold, every jade bangle gone.
And now the Xia family starts to sweat.
Yeah, they do.
The mother realizes this physical evidence looks terrible for her extortion case. If her daughter's jewelry is missing, it suggests a robbery, or worse, that her daughter was planning to run away and took her portable wealth with her.
Exactly. So Bao Chai sees the Xia family getting defensive. She realizes she has the upper hand, so she uses a brilliant psychological tactic.
She's so smart.
She is. She unties the disgruntled maid, Bao Chan. Bao Chai says, look, you're a straightforward person. Why take the fall for this? Just tell us the truth and clear your name right now before the authorities get here and start using torture to extract a confession.
Yeah, Bao Chai offers Bao Chan an out. She removes the immediate physical threat, the ropes, and replaces it with the looming systemic threat of the imperial courts.
Brilliant.
And Bao Chan, who is terrified of taking the blame for a murder she didn't commit, absolutely breaks down and confesses everything.
And the confession is wild. Bao Chan reveals Jingui's entire master plan. Xi Jingui, who was tired of her husband being in jail and hated her life in the Shu compound, had decided to basically burn the whole house down.
Right.
She bought the arsenic herself. She planned to poison the concubine Shangling, steal all of her own jewelry to make it look like a robbery, pack the wealth in a bag, run away back to her mother's house in the chaos, and eventually use the money to remarry someone else.
It was a highly calculated, ruthless plot for self-advancement.
Absolutely.
Jingui, we thought she had engineered the perfect escape. She would eliminate her rival, secure her portable wealth, and just vanish into a new life.
But here's the twist. Bao Chan was the one told to actually prepare the soup in the kitchen. Now, Bao Chan held her own petty, completely separate grudge against the sick concubine, Shangling.
Yeah.
Bao Chan thought, why does this miserable, sickly concubine deserve a nice hot bowl of soup made by me? So out of pure, spiteful insubordination, Bao Chan grabbed a massive handful of salt and dumped it into Shangling's bowl.
A petty workplace grievance. That's all it was. It wasn't a grand conspiracy. It was just a frustrated employee lashing out.
Wait, she literally just dumped salt in the soup. Why?
Just to ruin her meal.
That's it.
That's it. She wanted the concubine to take a bite and be disgusted. It was a juvenile prank born out of resentment.
That is unbelievable. So she carries the two bowls out to the room. One is laced with deadly arsenic by Jingui, intended for the concubine.
Right.
One is loaded with a disgusting amount of salt by Bao Chan, also intended for the concubine.
Right.
Jingui tells Bao Chan to run outside to the street and secretly hire a cart for her impending escape. Bao Chan leaves the room. When Bao Chan comes back in, she notices that the bowls on the table have been moved. The super salty bowl is now sitting right in front of Jingui.
And Bao Chan faces a split-second decision governed entirely by the fear of her toxic boss.
Exactly. Bao Chan thinks, if my mistress drinks that soup and it tastes like a salt mine, she's going to scream at me, beat me, and fire me.
Yep.
So while Jingui is looking the other way, adjusting her clothes or checking her bags, Bao Chan quickly swaps the two bowls back.
And she has absolutely no idea about the arsenic.
None.
She's just trying to avoid getting yelled at for a terrible culinary prank.
So Jingui turns back around. She sits down. She picks up the bowl in front of her, which she thinks is the safe bowl. But thanks to the maid's frantic swap, is now the poisoned bowl.
Wow.
Jingui confidently drinks the poisoned soup she herself bought and prepared while sitting there watching the concubine drink the salty soup. And then Jingui dies in unimaginable agony.
This is the absolute climax of this narrative's philosophy. The text explicitly calls this heaven's justice,
right,
which translates roughly to the clear manifestation of divine principle, harming one's own body. But what is truly fascinating here is how that justice is delivered.
Because it wasn't delivered by a brilliant detective uncovering clues, or a righteous judge banging a gavel, or a bolt of lightning from the sky.
No, Jingui's intricate, murderous master plan wasn't foiled by a grand force of good. It was foiled by the sheer, unpredictable friction of a disgruntled employee's petty insubordination.
Yeah.
It was foiled by a pinch of salt and a fear of being scolded.
It's like writing an incredibly complex million-dollar piece of malware designed to take down an entire banking system, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Calculating every firewall, every encryption key, and the whole grand scheme fails because a tired intern tripped over the server's power cord and unplugged it.
Yes.
The grandest malice undone by the most mundane human friction.
That is the perfect analogy. If we extrapolate on this theme of self-destruction, the narrative is making a profound statement about control. The more intricate and ruthless a person's plot for self-advancement becomes, the more vulnerable they are to the simplest, most mundane disruptions.
Right.
Jingli over-engineered her malice. She created a scenario so tightly wound, so dependent on everyone acting exactly as she predicted, that a single ignorant variable, a maid trying to avoid a scolding, was enough to reflect the violence entirely back onto the creator.
And look at the immediate resolution of this revelation. The Shia family, the mother who was just screaming for blood, swinging chairs and demanding money, suddenly realizes that the truth, the actual facts of the case, implicate her own dead daughter in an attempted murder and robbery plot.
Exactly.
If the authorities arrive and hear this confession, the Shia family won't get a payout. They might get arrested for complicity or for possession of the stolen goods if they take the bags.
So what do?
They instantly fold. The mother completely drops the grieving act. The tears stop. She turns to the Sioux family and literally begs them to stop the police investigation.
That's amazing.
She says, "Let's just drop this. My daughter was worthless anyway. Let's keep the authorities out of it."
It proves Bao Chai right. The outrage was entirely performative. Once the law ceases to be a tool for extortion and becomes a mechanism for actual accountability, the Shi family wants absolutely nothing to do with it.
They're out.
Yeah, the immediate chaos of the dead body is contained, but the toxicity of the environment, the greed, the fear, the desperation, remains entirely unresolved.
We have just witnessed the ultimate failure of worldly scheming. Lady Wang thinks she can control the world with bribes. Jingli thinks she can control her fate with poison. Both are trapped in this exhausting cycle of paranoia and self-destruction. So where do we go from here?
To understand the true antidote to this toxic environment, we really have to leave the claustrophobia of the city entirely. The narrative masterfully shifts focus, pulling us far away from the bloodstained carpets and the whispered bribes to a ruined temple by a river.
Yes, this brings us to a critical transition in the story. We catch up with a character named Jia Yukon. Now, the ambitious Mayor Yukon is an incredibly important figure.
Very important.
He is currently the mayor of the capital. He is a man of immense power. And he represents the absolute peak of the worldly success we've been talking about. He's out in the provinces, inspecting lands, traveling with a huge, wealthy entourage.
Yukon is the embodiment of the system that Lady Wang and Jilian are desperately trying to manipulate. He is a man who climbed the ranks through relentless ambition, ruthlessness, and deep moral compromises.
Yeah.
He is the winner of the game they are all playing.
Yeah, exactly. And during his travels, Yukon's grand procession stops at a place called the Rapid Current Ford. He leaves his opulent sedan chair and walks into a dilapidated, ruined little temple near the river.
Quite the contrast.
Really is. And inside this ruined temple, sitting on a simple mat in a grass hut beneath ancient pine trees, is an old Taoist monk. The monk is just sitting there with his eyes closed, meditating.
Visually and thematically, the contrast is stark. You have the mayor in his silk robes, surrounded by armed guards and servants, confronting an old man in a crumbling hut who possesses absolutely nothing.
Yukon looks closely at the monk and realizes he recognizes his face. He asks the old man about his origins, and the Taoist opens his eyes and, instead of giving a straight answer, recites a cryptic poem. He talks about a calabash providing shelter.
Let's unpack that symbol before we move on, because it's vital.
Please do.
In Taoist philosophy, the calabash, a hollowed-out gourd, is a deeply layered symbol. It represents emptiness, which is a state of spiritual purity.
Okay.
It is often depicted as a vessel used by immortals to carry magic elixirs or medicine. And philosophically, it represents a container that holds the entire universe.
Oh, wow.
So by saying a calabash provides his shelter, the monk is stating that he lives within the spiritual realm of emptiness and healing, far removed from the physical world of mansions and ministries.
That context makes his next lines even more powerful. After mentioning the calabash, the monk quotes two specific lines of poetry: "Jade in the box seeking a good price, hairpin in the case waiting to fly."
This is the philosophical anchor. Those two lines of poetry aren't just a random riddle. Decades ago, long before Yukon was a powerful mayor, He was an impoverished, hungry, fiercely ambitious young scholar, and he wrote that exact poem to express his burning desire for wealth, power, and societal recognition.
Oh.
He was the jade waiting for a buyer. He was the hairpin waiting to fly into the ranks of the elite.
Wow. So Yukon hears his own youthful ambition quoted back to him and immediately realizes who this monk is.
Yeah.
It is Zhen Xin. Xin was a wealthy, comfortable man who recognized Yukon's talent back when Yukon was poor. Xin was the one who gave Yukon the money and the clothes to travel to the capital and take the imperial exams.
Exactly.
Xin was Yukon's original benefactor.
But Xin's life took a drastically different path. While Yukon was climbing the ladder of corruption, Xinyin's life fell apart.
Really fell apart.
Yeah, his beloved daughter was kidnapped, his estate burned to the ground, he lost his wealth and was humiliated by his in-laws. Eventually, realizing the fragility of material wealth, he abandoned the worldly life entirely to become a wandering Taoist.
The Taoist is acting as a mirror to Yukon's lost innocence. By quoting Yukon's ambitious poetry back to him, Xin is reminding Yukon of the hollow pursuit of worldly success.
Right.
Xin represents the ultimate spiritual detachment. He experienced the height of wealth and the absolute depth of tragedy, and he chose to walk away from the game entirely.
So Yukon realizes he is standing in front of the man who essentially bought his career.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the powerful mayor's immediate reaction?
He says, oh my gosh, it's you. Come back to the capital with me right now. I will buy you a beautiful apartment. I will give you money. I will be your patron and take care of you forever.
Which completely tragically misses the point of everything the Taoist represents.
It's so painfully ironic. Yukon is looking at a man who has achieved spiritual peace specifically by shedding all material possessions. And Yukon tries to repay his spiritual debt using the corrupt currency of the material world.
Yeah.
He is offering a monk real estate.
It shows that Yukon's mind is entirely trapped within the paradigm we discussed at the very beginning with Lady Wang. To Yukon, every single problem in the universe can be solved with a placement, a bribe, or an apartment in the capital.
Right.
He literally cannot conceive of a reality where those things hold no value.
And Zhen Xin, the monk, just smiles at him. He gently refuses the offer. And then he says this profound, famous line, "What is true? What is false? True is false. False is true."
We have to explore the wordplay here because it reframes the entire saga.
Okay, let's hear it.
In the original language of the text, Zhen, the monk's surname, is a homophone for the word true. Jia Yukon's surname, which is also the surname of the aristocratic family doing the bribing, is a homophone for the word false.
Wait, so when he says true is false, false is true, he is literally playing with their names to make a philosophical point.
Yes. The Taoist is telling Yukon that the high-status, hyper-controlled, wealthy world Yukon occupies, the world of the Jia family, the world of Lady Wang's bribes, the world of Xi Jinghui's poison and the Xia family's extortion, all of it is an illusion. It is false. The power they are killing each other over isn't real. And the ruined temple, the detachment, the letting go of ambition, which looks like absolute failure to a man like Yukon, is actually true enlightenment.
Xian then gives Yukon a final warning. He tells the mayor to hurry up and cross the river because the wind and waves are about to rise.
Yeah.
And then Xian then just closes his eyes and goes back to meditating, completely ignoring the most powerful man in the province.
If we extrapolate on that warning, the wind and waves are clearly not just a weather forecast. It is a prophetic warning.
Definitely.
The rapid current of the river represents the relentless, unstoppable passage of time and karma. The wind and waves represent the impending total collapse of the fragile, corrupt system we've been analyzing.
It's all coming down.
The aristocratic families are rotting from the inside out, poisoned by their own greed and paranoia. The storm is coming, and all the bribes, missing jewelry, and apartments in the capital won't be able to stop it.